suicide stairs and home again. The questions remain. How much of her life is her own doing, and how much the doing of the box, with its treats and buttons? 10. Sophomore year opens with a bang. Within a month of the first day of classes, Gwendy is elected class president, named captain of the junior varsity soccer team, and asked to the homecoming dance by Harold Perkins, a handsome senior on the football squad. Alas, the homecoming date never happens, as Gwendy dumps poor Harold after he repeatedly tries to feel her up at a drive-in showing of Damnation Alley on their first date. Plenty of time for touchy-feely later, as her mother likes to say. For her 16th birthday in October, she gets a poster of the Eagles standing in front of Hotel California. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. A new stereo with both 8-track and cassette decks, and a promise from her father to teach her how to drive now that she's of legal age. The chocolate treats continue to come. No two ever the same, the detail always amazing. The tiny slice of heaven Gwendy devoured just this morning before school was a giraffe, and she purposely skipped brushing her teeth afterward. She wanted to savor the remarkable taste for as long as she could. Gwendy doesn't pull the other small lever nearly as often as she once did, for no other reason than she's finally run out of space to hide the silver coins. For now, the chocolate is enough. She still thinks about Mr. Ferris, not quite as often, and usually in the long, empty hours of the night, when she tries to remember exactly what he looked like or how his voice sounded. She's almost sure she once saw him in the crowd at the Castle Rock Halloween Fair, but she was high atop the Ferris wheel at that moment, and by the time the ride ended, he was gone, swallowed by the hordes of people flocking down the midway. Another time she went into a Portland coin shop with one of the silver dollars. The worth had gone up. The man offered her $750 for one of her 1891 Morgans, saying he'd never seen a better one. Gwendy refused, telling him on the spur of the moment that it was a gift from her grandfather and she only wanted to know what it was worth. Leaving, she saw a man looking at her from across the street. A man wearing a neat little black hat. Ferris, if it was Ferris, gave her a fleeting smile and disappeared around the corner. Watching her? Keeping track? Is it possible? She thinks it is. And she still thinks about the buttons, of course, especially the red one. She sometimes finds herself sitting cross-legged on the cold basement floor, holding the button box in her lap, staring at that red button in a kind of daze, and caressing it with the tip of her finger. She wonders what would happen if she pushed the red button without a clear choice of a place to blow up. What then? Who would decide what was destroyed? God? The box? A few weeks after her trip to the coin shop, Gwendy decides it's time to find out about the red button once and for all. Instead of spending her fifth period study hall in the library, she heads for Mr. Anderson's empty world history classroom. There's a reason for this. The pair of pull-down maps that are attached to Mr. Anderson's chalkboard. Gwendy has considered a number of possible targets for the red button. She hates that word. Target. But it fits, and she can't think of anything better. Among her initial options, the Castle Rock Dump, a stretch of trashy, pulped-over woods beyond the railroad tracks, and the old abandoned Phillips 66 gas station where kids hang out and smoke dope. In the end, she decides to not only target someplace outside of Castle Rock, but also the entire country. Better safe than sorry. She walks behind Mr. Anderson's desk and carefully studies the map, focusing first on Australia, where she recently learned over one-third of the country is desert, before moving on to Africa, those poor folks have enough problems, and finally settling on South America. From her history notes, Gwendy remembers two important facts that aid this decision. South America harbors 35 of the 50 least developed countries in the world, and a similar percentage of the least populated countries in the world. Now that the choice has been made, Gwendy doesn't waste any time. She scribbles down the names of three small countries in her spiral notebook, one from the north, one from the middle of the continent, and one from the south. Then she hurries to the library to do more research. She looks at pictures and makes a list of the most godforsaken ones. Later that afternoon, Gwendy sits down in front of her bedroom closet and balances the button box on her lap. She places a shaky finger on top of the red button. She closes her eyes and pictures one tiny part of a faraway country. Dense, tangled vegetation. An expanse of wild jungle where no people live. As many details as she can manage. She holds the image in her head and pushes the red button. Nothing happens. It doesn't go down. Gwendy stabs at the red button the second and third time. It doesn't budge under her finger. The part about the buttons was a practical joke, it seems, and gullible Gwendy Peterson believed it. Almost relieved, she starts to return the button box to the closet when Mr. Ferris's words suddenly come back to her.
The buttons are very hard to push. You have to use your thumb and put some real muscle into it, which is a good thing, believe me.
She lowers the box to her lap again and uses her thumb to press the red button. She puts all her weight onto it. This time, there's a barely audible click, and Gwendy feels the button depressed. She stares at the box for a moment, thinking, some trees and maybe a few animals, a small earthquake or maybe a fire. Surely no more than that. Then she returns it to its hiding place in the wall of the basement. Her face feels warm and her stomach hurts. Does that mean it's working? 11. Gwendy wakes up the next morning running a fever. She stays home from school and spends most of the day sleeping. She emerges from her bedroom later that evening feeling as good as new, and discovers her parents watching the news in silence. She can tell from the expressions on their faces that something is wrong. She eases down on the sofa next to her mother and watches in horror as Charles Gibson takes them to Guyana, a faraway country of which she recently learned a few salient details. There, a cult leader by the name of Jim Jones has committed suicide and ordered over 900 of his followers to do the same. Grainy photographs flash on the television screen. Bodies laid out in rows. Thick jungle looming in the background. Couples in a lover's embrace. Mothers clutching babies to still chests. So many children. Faces distorted in agony. Flies crawling all over everything. According to Charles Gibson, nurses squirted the poison down the kiddies' throats before taking their own doses. Gwendy returns to her bedroom without comment and slips on tennis shoes and a sweatshirt. She thinks about running suicide stairs but decides against it, vaguely afraid of an impulse to throw herself off. Instead, she travels a 3-mile loop around the neighborhood, her footsteps slapping a staccato rhythm on the cold pavement, crisp autumn air blushing her cheeks. "I did that," she thinks, picturing flies swarming over dead babies. "I didn't mean to, but I did." 12. "You looked right at me," Olive says. Her voice is calm, but her eyes are burning. "I don't know how you can say you didn't see me standing there."
"I didn't, I swear."
They are sitting in Gwendy's bedroom after school, listening to the new Billy Joel album and supposedly studying for an English midterm. Now it's obvious, Olive came over with what she likes to call issues. Olive often has issues these days.
"I find that hard to believe."
Gwendy's eyes go wide. "You're calling me a liar? Why in the world would I walk right by you without saying hello?" Olive shrugs, her lips pressed tight.
"Maybe you didn't want all your cool friends to know you used to hang out with other lowly sophomores."
"That's stupid. You're my best friend, Olive. Everyone knows that." Olive barks out a laugh.
"Best friend? Do you know the last time we've done something on a weekend? Forget Friday and Saturday nights with all your dates and parties and bonfires. I'm talking the entire weekend. Any time at all."
"I've been really busy," Gwendy says, looking away. She knows her friend is right. But why does she have to be so sensitive?
"I'm sorry." "And you don't even like half those guys. Bobby Crawford asks you out and you giggle and twirl your hair and say, sure, why not? Even though you barely know his name and could care less about him.
And just like that, Gwendy understands. How could I be so stupid? She wonders. I didn't know you liked Bobby. She scoots across the bedroom floor and puts her hand on her friend's knee. I swear I didn't. I'm sorry. Olive doesn't say anything. Apparently, the issue remains. That was months ago. Bobby's a really nice guy, but that's the only time I went out with him. If you want, I can call him and tell him about you. Olive pushes Gwendy's hand away and gets to her feet.
I don't need your goddamn charity.
She bends down and gathers her books and folders into her arms. It's not charity. I just thought...
That's your problem, Olive says, pulling away again. You only think about yourself. You're selfish.
She stomps out of the bedroom and slams the door behind her. Gwendy stands there in disbelief, her body trembling with hurt. Then the hurt blooms into anger.
Go to hell, she screams at the closed door. If you want to address an issue, try your jealous bone.
She flings herself back on the bed, tears streaming down her face, the hurtful words echoing.
You only think about yourself. You're selfish.
That's not true, Gwendy whispers to the empty room. I think about others. I try to be a good person. I made a mistake about Guyana, but I was tricked into it, and I wasn't the one who poisoned them. It wasn't me. Except it sort of was. Gwendy cries herself to sleep and dreams of nurses bearing syringes of Kool-Aid death to small children. 13. She tries to smooth things over the next day at school, but Olive refuses to talk to her. The following day, Friday, is more of the same. Just before the final bell rings, Gwendy slips a handwritten apology note inside Olive's locker and hopes for the best. On Saturday night, Gwendy and her date, a junior named Walter Dean, stop by the arcade on their way to an early movie. During the car ride over, Walter pulls out a bottle of wine he lifted from his mother's stash, and although Gwendy usually passes on such offers, tonight she helps herself. She's sad and confused and hopes the buzz will help. It doesn't. It only gives her a mild headache. Gwendy nods hello to several classmates as they enter the arcade and is surprised to see Olive standing in line at the snack bar. Hopeful, she flips her a tentative wave, but once again Olive ignores her. A moment later, Olive walks right past her, large soda cradled in her arms, nose in the air, giggling with a pack of girls Gwendy recognizes from a neighboring high school.
What's her problem?
Walter asks before sliding a quarter into a Space Invaders machine. Long story. Gwendy stares after her friend and her anger returns. She feels her face flush with annoyance. She knows what it was like for me. Hey, Goodyear, where's the football game? Hey, Goodyear, how's the view up there? She should be happy for me. She should be... 20 feet away from her, Olive screams as someone bumps her arm, sending a cascade of ice-cold soda all over her face and down the front of her brand-new sweater. Kids point and start to laugh. Olive looks around in embarrassment, her eyes finally settling on Gwendy, and then she storms away and disappears into the public restroom. Gwendy, remembering her dream about Frankie Stone, suddenly wants to go home and shut the door of her room and crawl under the covers. 14. The day before she's scheduled to attend junior prom with Walter Dean, Gwendy rolls out of bed late to discover that the basement has flooded overnight after a particularly heavy spring thunderstorm.
It's wetter than a taco fart down there and just as smelly, Mr. Peterson tells her. You sure you want to go down?
Gwendy nods, trying to hide her rising panic. I need to check on some old books and a pile of clothes I left for the laundry. Mr. Peterson shrugs his shoulders and returns his gaze to the small television on the kitchen counter.
Make sure you take off your shoes before you go. And hey, you might want to wear a life preserver.
Gwendy hurries down the basement stairs before he can change his mind and wades into a pool of ankle-high scummy gray water. Earlier this morning, Mr. Peterson managed to unclog the sump pump,
and Gwendy can hear it chugging away over in the far corner, but it's going to have a long day. She can tell by the waterline that marks the basement's stone walls that the floodwater has dropped maybe 2 inches at the most. She wades to the opposite side of the basement where the button box is hidden and pushes aside the old bureau. She drops to a knee in the corner and reaches down into the cloudy water, unable to see her hands, and works the stone free. Her fingers touch wet canvas. She pulls the waterlogged bag out of its hidey hole, puts it aside, and picks up the loose stone and places it back into the wall so her father won't notice it once the water has finished receding. She reaches to the side again for the canvas bag containing the box and coins, and it isn't there. She flails her hands under the water, trying desperately to locate the bag, but it's nowhere to be found. Black dots swim in her vision, and she suddenly feels lightheaded. She realizes she's forgotten to breathe, so she opens her mouth and takes in a big gulp of foul, moldy basement air. Her eyes and brain immediately begin to clear. Gwendy takes one more calming breath and once again reaches down into the dirty water, this time trying her other side. Right away, her fingers brush the canvas bag. She gets to her feet and like a weightlifter performing a deadlift squat. She raises the heavy bag to her waist and waddles her way across the basement to the shelves next to the washer and dryer. She grabs a couple of dry towels from an upper shelf and does the best she can to wrap the canvas bag. "You okay down there?" her father hollers from upstairs. She hears footsteps on the ceiling above her. "Need any help? Scuba tank and fins, maybe?" "No, no," Gwendy says, hurrying to make sure the bag is fully concealed. Her heart is a trip hammer in her chest. "I'll be up in a few."
"If you say so."
She listens to her father's muffled footsteps again, but going away, thank God. She grabs the bag again and shuffles across the flooded basement as fast as her tired legs will carry her, grunting with the weight of the box and the silver coins. Once she is safely inside her bedroom, she locks the door behind her and unwraps the canvas bag. The button box appears undamaged. But how would she really know? She pulls the lever on the left side of the box, and after a breathless moment, when she is absolutely convinced the box is broken after all, the little shelf slides open without a sound, and on it is a chocolate monkey the size of a jelly bean. She quickly stuffs the chocolate into her mouth, and that gorgeous flavor takes her away again. She closes her eyes while it melts on her tongue. The bag is ripped in several places and will have to be replaced, but Gwendy isn't worried about that. She looks around her bedroom and settles on the bottom of her closet, where her shoeboxes are stacked in messy piles. Her parents never bother with her closet these days. She removes an old pair of boots from their oversized cardboard box and tosses them to the opposite end of the closet. She carefully places the button box inside and adds the pile of silver coins. Once the lid is securely back on the shoebox, she slides it, it's too heavy to pick up now, the cardboard would surely tear, into the shadows at the very back of her closet. Once that's done, she stacks other shoeboxes on top and in front of it. She gets to her feet, backs up, and surveys her work. Convinced that she's done a competent job, she picks up the soaked canvas bag and heads for the kitchen to throw it away and grab some cereal for breakfast. She lazes around the house the rest of the day, watching television and skimming her history book. Every 30 minutes or so, more than a dozen times in all, she gets up from the sofa, walks down the hallway, and peeks her head into her bedroom to make sure the box is still safe. The next night is the prom, and she finds that she actually has to force herself to put on her pink gown and makeup and leave the house. "Is this my life now?" she thinks as she enters the Castle Rock gym. "Is that box my life?"
15. Coin and stamp show. Buy, sell, trade. Castle Rock VFW. Saturday, May 20. 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Refreshments sold.
Selling the silver coins isn't back on Gwendy's radar until she sees the advertising flyer taped to the front of the window at the Castle Rock Diner. After that, it's pretty much all she can think about. There was that one trip to the coin shop, true, but it was mostly of an exploratory nature. Now, however, things have changed. Gwendy wants to attend an Ivy League university after she graduates from high school, and those places don't come cheap. She plans to apply for grants and scholarships, and with her grades she's sure she'll get something, but enough? Probably not. Surely not. What is a sure thing are the 1891 Morgan silver dollars stacked inside a shoebox in the back of her closet. Over 100 of them at last count. Gwendy knows from leafing through back issues of Coinage magazine at the drugstore that the fair trade price of the Morgans is not just holding steady, their value is still rising. According to the magazine, inflation and global unrest are driving the market in gold and silver coins. Her first idea was to sell enough of the coins, maybe in Portland, more likely in Boston, to pay for college, and figure out how to explain the sudden windfall only when it becomes absolutely necessary. Maybe she'll say she found it. Hard to believe, but also hard to disprove. The best-laid plans of 16-year-olds are rarely thought out. The coin and stamp show flyer gives Gwendy another idea, a better idea. The plan is to take 2 of the silver dollars, enough to test the waters, and bike down to the VFW first thing this weekend to see what she can get for them. If they actually sell, and for real money, then she'll know. 16. The first thing Gwendy notices when she walks into the VFW at 10:15 on Saturday morning is the sheer size of the place. It didn't look nearly as spacious from the outside. The dealer tables are arranged in a long enclosed rectangle. The sellers, mostly men, stand on the inside of the rectangle. The customers, of whom there are already more than 2 or 3 dozen, circle the tables with wary eyes and nervous fingers. There doesn't seem to be a discernible pattern to the setup. Coin dealers here, stamp hucksters there, and more than a few of the merchants deal in both. A couple even have rare sports and tobacco cards fanned out across their tables. She is flabbergasted to see a signed Mickey Mantle card priced at $2,900, but in a way, relieved. It makes her silver dollars look like pretty small beans in comparison. She stands in the entryway and takes it all in. It's a whole new world, exotic and intimidating, and she feels overwhelmed. It must be obvious to anyone watching her because a nearby dealer calls out, "You lost, honey? Anything I can help you with?" He's a chubby man in his 30s, wearing glasses and an Orioles baseball cap. There's food in his beard and a twinkle in his eyes. Gwendy approaches his table. "I'm just looking right now, thanks."
"Looking to buy or looking to sell?"
The man's eyes drop to Gwendy's bare legs and linger there longer than they should. When he looks up again, he's grinning, and Gwendy doesn't like that twinkle anymore. "Just looking," she says, quickly walking away. She watches a man 2 tables down examining a tiny stamp with a magnifying glass and tweezers. She overhears him say, "I can go $70, and that's already 20 over my limit. My wife will kill me if I..." She doesn't stick around to see if he seals the deal. At the far end of the rectangle, she comes to a table covered exclusively with coins. She spots a Morgan silver dollar in the center of the last row. She takes this as a good sign. The man behind the table is bald and old. How old, she's not entirely sure, but at least old enough to be her grandfather. He smiles at Gwendy and doesn't glance at her legs, which is a good start. He taps the name tag attached to his shirt.
"Name's John Leonard, like it says, but I go by Lenny to my friends." "You look friendly. Is there anything special I can help you with today? Got a Lincoln penny book you want to finish filling out? Maybe looking for a Buffalo nickel or a few commemorative state quarters? I got a Utah. Very good condition and scarce."
I actually have something I'd like to sell. Maybe."
"Uh-huh. Okay. Well, let me take a look. I can tell you if we might do some business."
Gwendy takes the coins, each in its own little plastic envelope, out of her pocket and hands them to him. Lenny's fingers are thick and gnarled, but he slips the coins out with practiced ease, holding them by their thickness, not touching the heads and tail sides. Gwendy notices his eyes flash wider. He whistles.
"Mind if I ask where you got these?"
Gwendy tells him what she told the coin dealer in Portland. "My grandfather passed away recently and left them to me." The man looks genuinely pained.
Oh, I'm real sorry to hear that, honey.
Thank you, she says, and puts her hand out. I'm Gwendy Peterson. The man gives it a firm shake.
Gwendy, I like that.
Me too, Gwendy says and smiles.
Good thing, since I'm stuck with it.
The man turns on a small desk light and uses a magnifying glass to examine the silver dollars.
Never seen one in mint condition before, and here you've got two of them.
He looks up at her.
How old are you, Miss Gwendy, if you don't mind my asking?
16. The man snaps his fingers and points at her.
Ah, looking to buy a car, I bet.
She shakes her head. One day, but I'm thinking of selling these to make some money for college. I want to go to an Ivy League school after I graduate. The man nods his head with approval.
Good for you.
He studies the coins again with the magnifying glass.
Be honest with me now, Miss Gwendy. Your folks know you're selling these?
Yes, sir, they do. They're okay with it because it's for a good cause. His gaze turns shrewd.
But they're not with you, I notice.
Gwendy might not have been ready for this at 14, but she's older now and can hit the occasional adult curveball. They both said I have to start fending for myself sometime, and this might be a good place to start. Also, I read the magazine you've got there, she points. Coinage?
Uh-huh.
Lenny puts down the magnifying glass and gives her his full attention.
Well, Miss Gwendy Peterson, a Morgan silver dollar of this vintage and in near-mint condition can sell for anywhere from $725 to $800. A Morgan in this condition? He shakes his head. I honestly don't know.
Gwendy didn't practice this part.
How could she?
But she really likes the old man, so she wings it. My mom works at a car dealership, and they have a saying about some of the cars, priced to sell. So could you pay $800 each? Would that be priced to sell?
Yes, ma'am, it would, he says with no hesitation. Only are you sure? One of the bigger shops might be able to...
I'm sure. If you can pay $800 apiece, we have a deal. The old man chuckles and sticks out his hand.
Then, Miss Gwendy Peterson, we have ourselves a deal.
They shake on it.
I'll write you up a receipt and get you paid.
I'm sure you're trustworthy, Lenny, but I really wouldn't feel comfortable with a check.
With me up in Toronto or down in D.C. tomorrow, who'd blame you?
He drops her a wink.
Besides, I got a saying of my own. Cash don't tattle. And what Uncle Sammy don't know about our business won't hurt him.
Lenny slips the coins into their transparent envelopes and disappears them somewhere beneath the table. Once he's counted out 16 crisp $100 bills, Gwendy still can't believe this is happening. He writes a receipt, tears out a copy, and lays it atop the cash.
I put my phone number on there, too, in case your folks have any questions. How far is home?
About a mile. I rode my bike. He considers that.
Lot of money for a young girl, Gwendy. Think maybe you should call your parents for a ride?
No need, she says, smiling. I can take care of myself. The old man's eyebrows dance as he laughs.
I'll bet you can.
He stuffs the money and the receipt into an envelope. He folds the envelope in half and uses about a yard of scotch tape to seal it tight.
See if that'll fit nice and snug in your shorts pocket, he says, handing over the envelope.
Gwendy stuffs it into her pocket and pats the outside. Snug as a bug in a rug.
I like you, girl. I do. Got style and got sand. A combination that can't be beat.
Lenny turns to the dealer on his left.
Hank, you mind watching my table for a minute?
Only if you bring me back a soda, Hank says.
Done.
Lenny slips out from behind his table and escorts Gwendy to the door.
Are you sure you're going to be okay?
Positive. Thanks again, Mr. Lenny, she says, feeling the weight of the money inside her pocket. I really appreciate it.
The appreciation is all mine, Ms. Gwendy.
He holds the door open for her.
Good luck with the Ivy League.
17. Gwendy squints in the May sunlight as she unlocks her bike from a nearby tree. It never occurred to her this morning that the VFW wouldn't have a bike rack. Then again, how many vets did you see cruising around Castle Rock on bicycles? She pats her pocket to make sure the envelope is still nice and snug, then straddles her bike and pushes off. Halfway across the parking lot, she spots Frankie Stone and Jimmy's signs, checking car doors and peering into windows. Some unlucky person was going to walk out of the coin and stamp show today and find their car ransacked. Gwendy pedals faster, hoping to slip away unnoticed, but she's not that lucky.
"Hey, sugar tits!"
Frankie yells from behind her, and then he's sprinting ahead and cutting her off, blocking her exit from the parking lot. He waves his arms at her.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa!"
Gwendy skids to a stop in front of him. "Leave me alone, Frankie." It takes him a moment to catch his breath.
"I just wanted to ask you a question, that's all."
"Then ask it and get out of my way." She glances around for an escape route. Jimmy Sines emerges from behind a parked car, stands on the other side of her with his arms crossed. He looks at Frankie.
"Sugar tits, huh?"
Frankie grins.
"This is the one I was telling you about."
He walks closer to Gwendy, trails a finger up her leg. She swats it away. "Ask your question and move."
"Come on, don't be like that," he says. "I was just wondering how your ass is. You always had such a tight one. Must make it hard to take a shit."
He's touching her leg again. Not just a finger, his whole hand.
"These boys bothering you, Miss Gwendy?"
All three of them turn and look. Lenny is standing there.
"Get lost, old man," Frankie says, taking a step toward him.
"I don't think so. You okay, Gwendy?"
"I'm okay now." She pushes off and starts pedaling. "Gotta get going or I'm gonna be late for lunch."
"Thanks."
They watch her go, and then Frankie and Jimmy turn back to Lenny.
"It's 2-on-1. I like those odds, old-timer."
Lenny reaches into his pants pocket and comes out with a flick knife. Engraved on its silver side are the only two words of Latin these boys understand. Semper Fi. His gnarled hand does a limber trick, and presto, there's a 6-inch blade glittering in the sunlight.
"Now, it's 2-on-2.
Frankie takes off across the parking lot, Jimmy right behind him. 18.
"Imagine that. Gwendy wins again," Sally says, rolling her eyes and tossing her cards onto the carpet in front of her. There are four of them sitting in a circle on the Peterson's den floor. Gwendy, Sally Ackerman, Bridget Disjardin, and Josie Wainwright. The other three girls are seniors at Castle Rock High and frequent visitors to the Peterson home this school year.
"You ever notice that?" Josie says, scrunching up her face. "Gwendy never loses. At pretty much anything."
Sally rolls with it.
"Best grades in school, best athlete in school, prettiest girl in school, and a card shark to boot."
"Oh, shut up,"
Gwendy says, gathering the cards. It's her turn to shuffle and deal.
"That's not true."
But Gwendy knows it's true. And although Josie is just teasing her in her usual goofy way, who else would aspire to be a lead singer in a group called the Pussycats, she also knows that Sally isn't teasing at all. Sally is getting sick of it. Sally is getting jealous. Gwendy first realized it was becoming an issue a few months earlier. Yes, she's a fast runner, maybe the fastest varsity runner in the county, maybe in the entire state.
Really?
Yes, really. And then there are her grades. She always earned good ones in school, but in younger years she had to study hard for those grades, and even then, there were usually a handful of B's along with all those A's on her report card. Now she barely hits the books at all, and her grades are the highest in the whole junior class. She even finds herself writing down the wrong answers from time to time, just to avoid, ho-hum, another perfect test score, or forcing herself to lose at cards and arcade games just to keep her friends from becoming suspicious. Regardless of her efforts, they know something is weird anyway. Buttons aside, coins aside, little chocolate treats aside, the box has given her, well, powers.
Really?
Yes, really. She never gets hurt anymore. No strained muscles from track, no bumps or bruises from soccer, no nicks or scratches from being clumsy.
Not even a stubbed toe or broken fingernail. She can't remember the last time she needed a Band-Aid. Even her period is easy. No more cramps, a few drops on a sanitary pad, and done. These days, Wendy's blood stays where it belongs. These realizations are both fascinating and terrifying to Gwendy. She knows it's the box somehow doing this, or perhaps the chocolate treats, but they really are one and the same. Sometimes she wishes she could talk to someone about it. Sometimes she wishes she were still friends with Olive. She might be the only person in the whole world who would listen and believe her. Gwendy places the deck of cards on the floor and gets to her feet. Who wants popcorn and lemonade? Three hands go up. Gwendy disappears into the kitchen. 19. There are big changes in Gwendy's life during the fall and winter of 1978, most of them good ones. She finally gets her driver's license in late September, and a month later, on her 17th birthday, her parents surprise her with a gently used Ford Fiesta from the dealership where her mom works. The car is bright orange, and the radio only works when it wants to, but none of that matters to Gwendy. She loves this car, and plasters its meager back deck with big daisy decals and a No Nukes bumper sticker left over from the 60s. She also gets her first real job. She's earned money in the past, babysitting and raking leaves, but she doesn't count those. Working at the drive-in snack bar three nights a week. It surprises no one that she proves especially adept at her duties and earns a promotion by her third month of employment. She is also named captain of the varsity outdoor track team. Gwendy still wonders about Mr. Ferris, and she still worries about the button box, but not nearly with the same nervous intensity as she once did. She also still locks her bedroom door and slides the box out from inside her closet and pulls the lever for a chocolate treat, but not as often as she once did. Maybe twice a week now, tops. In fact, she's finally relaxed to the point where she actually finds herself wondering one afternoon, do you think you might eventually just forget about it? But then she stumbles upon a newspaper article about the accidental release of anthrax spores at a Soviet bioweapons facility that killed hundreds of people and threatened the countryside. And she knows that she will never forget about the box and its red button and the responsibility she has taken on. Exactly what responsibility is that? She's not sure, but thinks it might be to just keep things from, well, getting out of hand. It sounds crazy, but feels just about right. Near the end of her junior year, in March 1979, Gwendy watches television coverage of the nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. She becomes obsessed, combing over all the coverage she can find, mainly to determine how much of a danger the accident poses to surrounding communities and cities and states. The idea worries her. She tells herself she will press the red button again if she has to and make 3 Mile go away. Only Jonestown weighs heavy on her mind. Was that crazy religious fuck gonna do it anyway, or did she somehow push him into it? Were the nurses gonna poison those babies anyway? Or did Gwendy Peterson somehow give them the extra crazy they needed to do it? What if the button box is like the monkey's paw in that story? What if it makes things worse instead of better? What if she makes things worse? With Jonestown, I didn't understand. Now I do. And isn't that why Mr. Ferris trusted me with the box in the first place? To do the right thing when the time came? When the situation at 3 Mile Island is finally contained and subsequent studies prove there is no further danger, Gwendy is overjoyed and relieved. She feels like she's dodged a bullet. 20. The first thing Gwendy notices when she strolls into Castle Rock High on the last Thursday morning of the school year are the somber expressions on the faces of several teachers and a cluster of girls gathered by the cafeteria doors, many of them crying. "What's going on?" she asks Josie Wainwright at the locker they share. "What do you mean?" "Kids are crying in the lobby. Everyone looks upset." "Oh, that," Josie says, with no more gravity than if she were talking about what she'd eaten for breakfast that morning. "Some girl killed herself last night, jumped off the suicide stairs." Wendy's entire body goes cold.
What girl?
Barely a whisper, because she's afraid she already knows the answer. She doesn't know how she knows, but she does. Olive, Kepnes. Her name is Olive Kepnes.
Was Olive Kepnes, Josie says, and starts humming the Dead March.
Gwendy wants to smack her, right in her pretty freckled face, but she can't lift her arms. Her entire body is numb. After a moment, she wills her legs to move and walks out of the school into her car. She drives directly home and locks herself inside her bedroom. 21.
It's my fault,
Gwendy thinks for the 100th time, as she pulls her car into the Castleview Recreational Park parking lot. It's almost midnight and the gravel lot is empty.
If I'd stayed her friend.
She's told her parents that she's sleeping over at Maggie Bean's house with a bunch of girlfriends from school, all of them telling stories and reminiscing about Olive and supporting each other in their grief, and her parents believe her. They don't understand that Gwendy stopped running with Olive's crowd a long time ago. Most of the girls Gwendy hangs out with now wouldn't recognize Olive if she were standing in front of them. Other than a quick, hey, in the hallways at school, or the occasional encounter at the supermarket, Gwendy hasn't spoken to Olive in probably 6 or 7 months. They eventually made up their fight in Gwendy's bedroom, but nothing had been the same after that day. And the truth of the matter is that had been okay with Gwendy. Olive was getting to be too damn sensitive, too high maintenance, just too Olive. It's my fault, Gwendy mutters as she gets out of the car. She'd like to believe that's just adolescent angst, what her father calls teenage it's-all-about-me complex, but she can't quite get there. Can't help realizing that if she and Olive had stayed tight, the girl would still be alive. There's no moon in the sky tonight, and she forgot to bring along a flashlight, but that doesn't matter to Gwendy. She strikes off in the dark at a brisk pace and heads for the suicide stairs, unsure of what she's going to do once she gets there. She's halfway across the park before she realizes she doesn't want to go to the suicide stairs at all. In fact, she never wants to see them again. Because, this is crazy, but in the dark it has the force of truth. What if she met Olive halfway up? Olive, with her head half bashed in and one eye dangling on her cheek. What if Olive pushed her, or talked her into jumping? Gwendy turns around, climbs back into her cute little Fiesta, and drives home. It occurs to her that she can make damn sure no one jumps from those stairs again. 22. The Castle Rock Call. Saturday edition, May 26, 1979. Sometime between the hours of 1 a.m. and 6 a.m., on the morning of Friday, May 25, a portion of the northeastern corner of the Castleview Recreational Park was destroyed. The historic stairway and viewing platform, as well as nearly one half acre of state-owned property, collapsed, leaving a bewildering pile of iron, steel, earth, and rubble below. Numerous authorities are still on site, investigating the scene to determine if the collapse was a result of natural or man-made causes. It's just the strangest thing, and way too early for answers, Castle Rock Sheriff George Bannerman commented. We don't know if there was a minor earthquake centered in this area, or if someone somehow sabotaged the stairs or what. We're bringing in additional investigators from Portland, but they're not expected to arrive until tomorrow morning, so it's best we wait until that time to make any further announcements. Castleview was recently the scene of tragedy, when the body of a 17-year-old female was discovered at the base of the cliff. 23. Gwendy is sick, for days afterward. Mr. and Mrs. Peterson believe grief is causing their daughter's fever and upset stomach. But Gwendy knows better. It's the box. It's the price she has to pay for pushing the red button. She heard the rumble of the collapsing rocks and had to run into the bathroom and vomit. She manages to shower and change out of baggy sweatpants and a t-shirt long enough to attend Olive's funeral on Monday morning, but only after her mother's prompting. If it were up to Gwendy, she wouldn't have left her bedroom. Maybe not until she was 24 or so.
The church is SRO. Most of Castle Rock High School is there, teachers and students alike. Even Frankie Stone is there, smirking in the back pew. And Gwendy hates them all for showing up. None of them even liked Olive when she was alive. None of them even knew her. Yeah, like I did, Gwendy thinks. But at least I did something about it. There's that. No one else will ever jump from those stairs, ever. Walking from the gravesite back to her parents' car after the service, someone calls out to her. She turns and sees Olive's father. Mr. Kepnes is a short man, barrel-chested, with rosy cheeks and kind eyes. Gwendy has always adored him and shared a special bond with Olive's father, perhaps because they once shared the burden of being overweight, or perhaps because Mr. Kepnes is one of the sweetest people Gwendy has ever known. She held it together pretty well during the funeral service, but now, with Olive's father approaching, arms outstretched, Gwendy loses it and begins to sob.
"It's okay, honey," Mr. Kepnes says, wrapping her up in a bear hug. "It's okay."
Gwendy vehemently shakes her head. "It's not." Her face is a mess of tears and snot. She wipes it with her sleeve.
"Listen to me."
Mr. Kepnes leans down and makes sure Gwendy is looking at him. It's wrong for the father to be comforting the friend, the ex-friend. But that is exactly what he's doing.
"It has to be okay. I know it doesn't feel like it right now, but it has to be."
"Got it." Gwendy nods her head and whispers,
"Got it."
She just wants to go home.
"You are her best friend in the world, Gwendy.
Maybe in a couple of weeks you can come see us at the house. We can all sit down and have some lunch and talk. I think Olive would have liked that."
It's too much, and Gwendy can no longer bear it. She pulls away and flees for the car, her apologetic parents trailing behind her. The final 2 days of school are canceled because of the tragedy. Gwendy spends most of the next week on the den sofa buried beneath a blanket. She has many bad dreams, the worst of them featuring a man in a black suit and black hat, shiny silver coins where his eyes should be, and often cries out in her sleep. She's afraid of what she might say during these nightmares. She's afraid her parents might overhear. Eventually the fever breaks and Gwendy re-enters the world. She spends the majority of her summer vacation working as much as she can at the snack bar. When she's not working, she's jogging the sun-baked roads of Castle Rock or locked inside her bedroom listening to music. Anything to keep her mind busy. The button box stays hidden in the back of the closet. Gwendy still thinks about it. Boy, does she. But she wants nothing to do with it anymore. Not the chocolate treats, not the silver coins, and most of all, not the goddamn buttons. Most days she hates the box, and everything it reminds her of, and she fantasizes about getting rid of it, crushing it with a sledgehammer or wrapping it up in a blanket and driving it out to the dump. But she knows she can't do that. What if someone else finds it? What if someone else pushes one of the buttons? She leaves it there in the dark shadows of her closet, growing cobwebs and gathering dust. Let the damn thing rot for all I care, she thinks. 24. Gwendy is sunbathing in the backyard, listening to Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band on a Sony Walkman, when Mrs. Peterson comes outside carrying a glass of ice water. Her mother hands Gwendy the glass and sits down on the end of the lawn chair.
"You doing okay, honey?"
Gwendy slips off the headphones and takes a drink.
"I'm fine."
Mrs. Peterson gives her a look.
"Okay, maybe not fine, but I'm doing better."
"I hope so." She gives Gwendy's leg a squeeze. "You know we're here, if you ever want to talk. About anything."
"I know."
"You're just so quiet all the time, we worry about you."
"I have a lot on my mind."
"Still not ready to call Mr. Kepnes back?" Gwendy doesn't answer, only shakes her head. Mrs. Peterson gets up from the lawn chair.
"Just remember one thing."
"What's that?"
"It will get better. It always does."
It's pretty much what Olive's father said. Gwendy hopes it's true, but she has her doubts. "Hey, Mom." Mrs. Peterson stops and turns around. I love you. 25. As it turns out, Mr. Kepnes was wrong, and Mrs. Peterson was right. Things are not okay. But they do get better. Gwendy meets a boy. His name is Harry Streeter. He's 18 years old, tall and handsome and funny. He's new to Castle Rock. His family just moved in a couple of weeks ago as a result of his father's job transfer. And if it's not a genuine case of love at first sight, it's pretty close. Gwendy is behind the counter at the snack bar, hustling tubs of buttered popcorn, Laffy Taffy, Pop Rocks, and soda by the gallon, when Harry walks in with his younger brother. She notices him right away, and he notices her. When it's his turn to order, the sparks jump and neither of them can manage a complete sentence. Harry returns the next night by himself this time, even though the Amityville Horror and Phantasm are still playing, and once again he waits his turn in line. This time, along with a small popcorn and soda, he asks Gwendy for her phone number. He calls the next afternoon and that evening picks her up in a candy apple red Mustang convertible. With his blonde hair and blue eyes, he looks like a movie star. They go bowling and have pizza on their first date, skating at the Gates Falls roller rink on their second, and after that, they are inseparable. Picnics at Castle Lake, day trips to Portland to visit museums and the big shopping mall, movies, walks. They even jog together, keeping in perfect step. By the time school starts, Gwendy is wearing Harry's school ring on a silver chain around her neck and trying to figure out how to talk to her mother about birth control. This talk won't happen until the school year is almost 2 months old, but when it does, Gwendy is relieved to find that her mother is not only understanding, she even calls and makes the doctor's appointment for her. Go, Mom. There are other changes, too. Much to the dismay of the coaching staff and her teammates, Gwendy decides to skip her senior season on the girls' soccer team. Her heart just isn't in it. Besides, Harry isn't a jock. He's a serious photographer, and this way they can spend more time together. Gwendy can't remember ever being this happy. The button box still surfaces in her thoughts from time to time, but it's almost as if the whole thing was a dream from her childhood. Mr. Ferris, the chocolate treats, the silver dollars, the red button. Was any of it real? Running, however, is not negotiable. When indoor track season rolls around in late November, Gwendy is ready to rock and roll. Harry is there on the sidelines for every meet, snapping pics and cheering her on. Despite training most of the summer and into the fall, Gwendy finishes a disappointing fourth in counties and doesn't qualify for states for the first time in her high school career. She also brings home 2 B's on her semester-ending report card in December. On the third morning of Christmas break, Gwendy wakes up and shuffles to the hallway bathroom to take her morning pee. When she's finished, she uses her right foot to slide the scale out from underneath the bathroom vanity, and she steps onto it. Her instincts are right. She has gained 6 pounds. 26. Gwendy's first impulse is to sprint down the hallway, lock her bedroom door, and yank out the button box so she can pull the small lever and devour a magic chocolate treat. She can almost hear the voices chanting in her head, "Good year, good year, good year." But she doesn't do that. Instead, she closes the toilet lid and sits back down. Let's see. I bombed my track season, pulled a pair of B's for the semester, one of them just barely a B, although her parents don't know that. And I gained weight. 6 whole pounds for the first time in years. And I am still the happiest I've ever been. I don't need it, she thinks. More importantly, I don't want it. The realization makes her head sing and her heart soar, and Gwendy returns to her bedroom with a spring to her step and a smile on her face. 27. The next morning, Gwendy wakes up on the floor of her closet. She's cradling the button box in her arms like a faithful lover, and her right thumb is resting a half inch from the black button.
She stifles a scream and jerks her hand away, scrambling like a crab out of the closet. A safe distance away, she gets to her feet and notices something that makes her head swim. The narrow wooden shelf on the button box is standing open. On it is a tiny chocolate treat. A parrot, every feather perfect. Gwendy wants more than anything to run from the room, slam the door behind her, and never return, but she knows she can't do that. So what can she do? She approaches the button box with as much stealth as she can muster. When she's within a few feet of it, the image of a wild animal asleep in its lair flashes in her head, and she thinks, the button box doesn't just give power. It is power. But I won't, she mutters. Won't what? Won't give in. Before she can chicken out, she lunges and snatches the piece of chocolate from the little shelf. She backs out of the bedroom, afraid to turn her back on the button box, hurries down the hall into the bathroom, where she hurls the chocolate parrot into the toilet and flushes it away. And for a while, everything is all right. She thinks the button box goes to sleep, but she doesn't trust that. Not a bit. Because even if it does, it sleeps with one eye open. 28. Two life-changing events occur at the start of Gwendy's final semester of high school. Her college application to study psychology at Brown University is granted for an early acceptance, and she sleeps with Harry for the first time. There have been several false starts over the past few months. Gwendy has been on the pill for at least that long, but each time she isn't quite ready, and gallant Harry Streeter doesn't pressure her. The deed finally goes down in Harry's candlelit bedroom on the Friday night of his father's big work party, and it is every bit as awkward and wonderful as expected. To make the necessary improvements, Gwendy and Harry do it again the next two nights in the back seat of Harry's Mustang. It's cramped back there, but it only gets better. Gwendy runs outdoor track again when spring comes and places in the top three in her first two meets. Her grades are currently A's across the board, although history is hovering in the danger zone at 91%. And she hasn't stepped on a scale since the week before Christmas. She's done with that nonsense. She still suffers from the occasional nightmare, the one featuring the well-dressed man with the silver coin eyes continuing to be the most terrifying, and she still knows the button box wants her back, but she tries not to dwell on that. Most days she is successful, thanks to Harry and what she thinks of as her new life. She often daydreams that Mr. Ferris will return to take back possession of the button box, relieving her of the responsibility, or that the box will eventually forget about her. That would sound stupid to an outsider, but Gwendy has come to believe that the box is in some way alive. Only there will be no forgetting. She discovers this on a breezy spring afternoon in April, while she and Harry are flying a kite in the outfield of the Castle Rock High baseball field. Gwendy was delighted when he showed up at her house with the kite in tow. She notices something small and dark emerge from the tree line bordering the school property. At first she thinks it's an animal of some sort, a bunny or perhaps a woodchuck on the move. But as it gets closer, and it seems to head directly at them, she realizes that it's not an animal at all. It's a hat. Harry is holding the spool of string and staring up at the red, white, and blue kite with wide eyes and a smile on his face. He doesn't notice the black hat coming in their direction, not moving with the wind, but against it. He doesn't notice the hat slow down as it approaches, then suddenly change direction and swoop a complete circle around his horror-struck girlfriend, almost as if kissing her hello, so nice to see you again, before it skitters off and disappears behind the bleachers that run alongside the third baseline. Harry notices none of these things, because it's a gorgeous spring afternoon in Castle Rock, and he's flying a kite with the love of his young life at his side, and everything is perfect. 29. The first half of May passes in a blur of classes, tests, and graduation planning. Everything from sizing caps and gowns to sending out commencement notices in the mail
to finalizing graduation night party arrangements. Final exams are scheduled for the week of May 19th, and the Castle Rock High School graduation ceremony will take place on the football field the following Tuesday, the 27th. For Gwendy and Harry, everything is set. After the ceremony is finished,